Fritz rocks. 91.3 FM, WLVR, Bethlehem. We just heard Stay Out of Automobiles and Tough It Out from Webb Wilder and the Beatnik's latest live album, Born to be Wilder, on Blind Pig Records. Before that, we heard studio cuts from Hybrid Vigor. We played Hitting Where It Hurts and The Human Cannonball. And from Doodad, we heard Hoodoo Witch, and started the set with Battle of the Bands from Webb's 2005 release, About Time. Today, we are joined by the last of the full-grown men, a southern gentleman rock and roller to the core, actor, filmmaker, and the only rock and roller with a credo, the incredible Webb Wilder. Webb, you there?
I am, AJ. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, and how are the Beatnik's doing?
They're all doing good, and may I say I'm proud to be on the Fritz.
I appreciate that, man. How'd the whole Blind Pig release come about for you and the band?
Well, I guess it came about in an indirect way, and it's a nice thing. I'm glad it did come about. I did the very first album, you know, way years ago. It came from Nashville for Landslide Records, and then, you know, was on other labels, some of which were major labels, and had been not making records for a long time, but still playing live when I got rehooked up with Michael Rothschild and Landslide Records, which led to About Time and the live DVD called Tough It Out. Michael then licensed the bonus CD we had included with that package to Dixie Frog Records in France, who Blind Pig has done a lot of business with.
Oh, okay.
And that made them aware of it, and they put it out over here. So we went and toured behind the very same record with different packaging and title. Over there they call it It's Live Time.
All right.
In France, and now it's out here with a different, you know, artwork and everything called Born to be Wilder.
Well, I gotta tell you, first off, I've listened to the album a couple of times. It really does capture what Webb Wilder and the Beatnik's are all about.
I appreciate that.
You should be quite proud of this record, and we want to, you know, say congratulations on putting out a great live release. Now, what can people expect to hear if they've never listened or heard of Webb Wilder? What can they expect to hear from you and the Beatnik's on this record?
I think I'm right in saying that there's probably something from every record we ever did on there up through that point, because we do some of the About Time songs, and we do, you know, Tough It Out's the first song, that's from Doodad. Louisiana Hannah and Cannonball are from Hybrid Vigor. I can't remember if there's anything from Acres of Suede, but I know there's Automobiles from Town and Country, and there's got to be something from It Came from Nashville. I'm not looking at one of the records, and the titles vary from the DVD a little bit. So I think How Long Can She Last or Poolside or something from It Came from Nashville's on there. Had to Laugh from About Time. And, you know, it's this, people wouldn't realize that you're not as, you get so close to your own records making them.
Yeah.
That sometimes you know, you don't listen to your own records. Plus, what happened is I was more familiar with the show in the chronological order of the DVD.
Okay.
But Bobby Field resequenced select cuts for that CD, which made it a stronger live album. You know,
oh.
He looked at it more like an album, and that was smart, and I think. And it even has different mastering than the DVD.
Okay. And let's talk a little bit about the Beatnik's. Some great players there.
Yeah, they're unbelievable. And we had, that's an unusual show in that for, you know, what, 20-something years now, we've played two guitars, bass, and drums. But when we got our heads around the idea of doing this DVD, the lead guitar position, you know, has been swapped around a lot. And George Bradfield was doing a bunch of the gigs, and Tony Bowles was doing a bunch of the gigs. And maybe it was Bobby, I don't know, somebody said, why don't we just use both of them? And we did, and we were able to cover more of the parts of the records, and it didn't get in my way at all. It just helped me, and I played all the same stuff I always play. So that was fun, but it's very unusual. So usually when you come to see me, it's going to be not three guitars, but two.
But two, yeah. How about talking a little bit about your good buddy and producer for, I guess, all your records, really, Bobby R.S. Field.
Well, I think what I used to say is when they made him, authorities came and required them to break the mold.
How'd you two guys get together? I know he's a couple years older than you, and you guys actually go back way back to, you know, to school. He was a few years older than you, but You've known him for a long time, I take it.
Yeah, you're a Wilderian scholar, so obviously you know the story.
Yeah.
I think some of the best bands are the ones where somehow people are able to kind of come from the same place and somehow stay together. And, you have Mick and Keith and the Stones going back so far, and U2 like that, and Aerosmith, is more or less like that, and AC/DC, but it's really rare, and it's really hard to do, and it didn't work out that way for us, in that Bobby was the drummer for a very brief time, but he was such an architect of the whole concept of the thing early on. He left the band as a drummer, choosing his own replacement in Jimmy Lester, who, as soon as I met, I felt like I had known all my life, and he's been the drummer more often than anyone else since 1985, but I'm not answering your question properly. So, we're both from this little town that's now maybe a medium sized town in South Mississippi called Hattiesburg, and Bobby went to another elementary school, another junior high, but there was a real uniting force in this thing called the Teen Center where the teen bands played.
Okay,
and he was in a band before me. And he was kind of a flash drummer, and he just had a real sense of style with his clothes and the songs they chose for the band and everything else. And I really thought, this guy's pretty cool. I need to get to know him. And then I did. So by the time I was about 14, I began a friendship with him. But truth be known, his mother was my first Sunday school teacher, which I don't even remember. We belonged to the same church. So in a town like that, you know people before you know them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually wandered into this situation when I was maybe 12 or 13, where his first band was just forming, and they set up on the stairs of what we called the parish hall. It was an Episcopal church, and the Sunday school building was called the parish hall, and his first band was called the Flowers, Phlowurz.
Okay.
And they were and I was just obsessed with rock and roll, but I was kind of a punk kid, and they were talking about doing something, and they were talking about Parver and the Raiders, and I told them I knew how to sing just like me, which I didn't. I didn't know most of the words, but okay. They let me get on the mic and sing it. So actually, that was my first time to ever sing on a mic. So that's the kind of thing that goes back really far.
Was there a defining moment for you that led you to becoming a rock and roller, a singer, songwriter, and so forth? I mean, was there a spark that just kicked this whole thing off for you when you were a young man, or what?
Well, I'm sure there was. I'm not sure exactly when. It's sort of like a series of sparks, I guess. But, my aunt, whose name was Montressa Wilder, was like a second mother to me. And she lived with our family on and off most of the time she was living with us. And she said I sang before I talked,
How about that?
Yeah, and it sounds really dramatic until I inquired a little further. So, well, what was it that I sang? And she said, I don't know, la 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 or something. So it really wasn't that great. But I was the only kid in the fourth grade who already had records and was interested in music and seriously in records when the Beatles took America by storm.
Okay.
And so, I had Elvis and Ricky Nelson, and looking back, that meant something, that I was kind of serious about it. But I went through this whole thing of, no one in my family, well, this is another irony, no one that I knew about in my family had ever made a living as a musician, so I didn't think anybody could.
But there was someone who did make a living somewhat.
As it turns out, there was, and she was incredibly historically significant.
Yeah.
So I was led into it through my own inclinations and the media and just being born to be Wilder, but the story with that is that my aunt and uncle, you see, my dad had two brothers, and each one of these guys had their own furniture stores.
Okay.
And so, it's a patriarchal society, and it's the 50s and 60s, and, it looks to me like mom stays at home, and the dads have the furniture stores. And so what I didn't know, though, is that my Uncle Willard's wife, Lillian, had been this lightning rod of a person, and she and he had this label called Trumpet Records that kind of folded about the time I was born, and they had lost a lot of money but had a lot of success at the same time. They couldn't get paid by distributors, but they had jukebox hits and stuff on artists who had proved to be iconic. So they really were pioneers in the recording industry. They recorded before tape with a cold needle direct to disc.
Wow.
And they recorded Sonny Boy Williamson and Elmore James. You know, and so, but that had nothing to do with me playing music. I didn't know about that. And it was really weird. And, you know, my parents didn't listen to Elmore James, so that wouldn't have really impressed them, you know.
Sure.
But I was going out the door as a, you know, young teen or junior high person or whatever with a vinyl copy of Tommy by The Who.
Yeah.
And it turns out I was born on Pete Townsend's birthday.
Oh, wow, that's too wild, man.
and Hi-Watt seems to be my amp of choice, so, you know, I'm just born to be wilder. But
I guess.
So I'm going out the door with this thing, and, you know, when you're that age, you just want to get out of the radar of the grown-ups as quickly as possible.
Oh, sure.
You later realize you could have hung out and learned a lot.
But, well, yeah, right.
Willard and Lillian were visiting with my parents, and so Lillian, who was a very distinctive character, said, I thought the rock opera was an abortion. And I thought, wow, nobody uses words like that around my house, and they sure don't comment on British rock groups like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I came to find out is, well, they had done her song, more or less, wrong. I mean, they had done Eyesight to the Blind by Sonny Boy Williamson in a minor Episcopal kind of arrangement. She had cut the original version on Sonny Boy Williamson. It was his first recording, and, you know, it was more like Boogie Woogie. So that's when I really realized, okay, it didn't come from England. It came from right here.
Yeah, it all started here. All the British acts were looking across the pond and getting their roots from what was happening here, especially in the South. It's you know, like, hey, the blues had a baby, called it rock and roll, I guess, you know?
Well, as white suburban kids, they kind of gave our music back to us.
Yeah.
You know, because we grew up in this Afro-Celtic culture, and I realize now that the things that influenced me were the media, radio and television, and records, and that the indirect factors being, you know, in that insular deep South back then when it was more intact and, you know, we hadn't had the homogenization of America like we do now with the corporatization, the Mick culture that we live in that I talk about.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it was great. So, you know, you're absorbing that. So a lot of those bands down there really kind of had an R&B. Even the white teen bands, you know, had kind of an R&B soulfulness. And I think you'll find that of the Texas bands of the period, too.
Sure. Well, let me ask you about this. How the whole alien detective thing started? I want to touch a little bit. I mean, you've given us some great music over the years and continue to give us great music, but there's a side to you that maybe other people don't know about with Webb Wilder and the actual flicks that you've done, and you've done a few now, and I was watching some of the trailers, really good stuff, and in fact, not only have you've done these films, but these films have also been recognized, like the Webb Wilder Private Eye Grand Prize winner of the Texas Union National Student Film Competition. And actually, people might remember you from the A&E Network and the USA Network show Night Flight, with having your films played there. How'd that whole thing come about?
Well, you've done your homework, and that's something you get big points from me for. But you got to get back to Bobby Field there, too.
Okay.
And, had it not been for Bobby, I don't know that I would have really ever made a record or a film or, you know, been a DJ or done voiceover work or any of that stuff. And the guy has a big imagination.
Okay.
So
obviously.
Yeah, and also there's another key figure in this, Steve Mims.
Okay.
And Steve Mims is younger than me or Bobby, And Bobby and I had basically moved to Texas together to do the whole Austin thing, you know, in the 70s with different bands. And he got married, and he was offered a job. We had both attended the University of Southern Mississippi in Hattiesburg, and he had had a job, student job, filming football games for the Office of Public Relations.
Okay.
So that ended. He graduated, whatever, and I graduated some point with the English degree. He had like a master's degree in educational media and a, you know, history minor and all this stuff. So we were in Texas, though, and he'd gotten married, and he got this offer to come back and do his old job, but in a full-time way with more money and more whatever responsibility. And he felt obligated to take it, you know, and so he went back to Mississippi. So, you know, I was kind of going like, well, I'm not in a band. I'm out here doing these crummy dead end, you know, work at the mall kind of jobs and stuff. And my mother's a widow, and, you know, she'd like to have me back. And I'm in my 20s, you know, I'm in my early 20s. So what the hell, I can always come back to Austin. So I went back to Mississippi too. And so in doing this job, he had a film student, naturally, assistant, who was ambitious and smart and needed a senior project. So Webb Wilder Private Eye was Steve Mims' senior project, but it was basically co-written by Bobby and Steve, and Bobby had a lot of the conceptual stuff. And the character was kind of inspired, among other things, by a hat trick, if you will, because I was living with a guy who had a Stetson, and I had a Resistol, and this guy was like a long-haired, redneck hippie kind of guy. You know, he was the perfect, ideal, progressive country demographic.
Sure.
But he had been to the Gulf Coast to like a rock and roll revival show with Jerry Lee and Chuck Berry, and he got hassled by an off-duty highway patrolman, and he lost his hat.
Oh, man, all right.
Yeah, so I gave him my hat.
Okay.
I gave him my Resistol, so I needed a hat. I didn't have a hat anymore.
Right.
So I went out to this Western store, and I'd been seeing these pictures of Merle Haggard wearing smaller hats, you know, like LBJ-ish kind of hats.
Yeah, yes.
Well, that'd be cool, you know. So being unable to resist messing with any hat I buy, which is another Merle thing he does too, I messed with it and recreased it and everything, and Bobby went, wow, that's a cool hat. And I really think that helped him buzz on this character. And Webb is my middle name. And bam, you know, next thing you know, we're rolling and we're doing this thing. And I remembered how Fess Parker talked as Daniel Boone. He was real, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. And that was sort of what I drew on for the delivery of that character. So I was in this band called The Drapes at the time, and you were talking like 1981, and we made this film, and we used, as we have in all of them, a bunch of our friends and non-professional actors and stuff, and there was something about it, and Steve really captured that, in my opinion, that high-contrast sort of early Andy Griffith show, Black and White.
Yeah.
I love the look of that film, and it, you know, got him an A and won these, as you pointed out, it won these film festival contests and went on to be on national cable television. So there you go.
You know, it's something that's definitely different from a rock and roller. It's not something that you usually see combined with a rock and roller, so I figured I'd bring it up and talk a little bit about it. Are there any plans for you to do any more of these types of films?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because people asked me that for years, and for years I just said, well, if the opportunity presented itself, we would do it, you know. And we never planned it this way, but we have done these films years apart. So we did the first one, you know, and then pursuing music, see, the whole time, you know, I was in a band from 14 on. So, but then we had the BMG, Zoopraxis BMG deal with Doodad, and that produced Horror Hayride, right?
Yeah.
So that was like 10 years after the first one.
After the first one, yeah.
And then we put those two and one of Steve's other films,
Aunt Hallie.
Yeah, out as Cornflicks.
Cornflicks, right, with you on the cover. And I can't quite tell what is in the bowl there that you're holding.
It's some film and milk.
Is that what it is, film and milk?
Yeah, and that was shot somewhere in L.A., and that was fun. But anyway, so years pass, right? And
yeah.
You know, do some other records and lots of touring, and I did this Peter Bogdanovich movie. I had a speaking role in it called The Thing Called Love, and, you know, a guy named Danny Boyd had me appear in an independent film of his, and, you know, I did some commercials and records and touring and the DJ thing, and was still doing all of that when... Well, actually, I wasn't doing the satellite radio DJ anymore. That had just ended when there was an opportunity to do the film that we did in the summer of, I think, 2006, which is called Scattergun. And if you go to webwilderfilms.com, you can see a little trailer from it, and you can see some pictures. And Steve Mims swears that he's going to get this out on a DVD, and we hope, with maybe some more stuff to boot.
Now, how long is that film? I was watching the trailer for it, and I was watching the outtakes, too, where you are slapping the guy.
Yeah.
Funny stuff, man. Really great stuff. So deadpan and, And I just like the whole look of it. How long is the film?
I think it's about 30 minutes long.
Okay, so then this may be something that maybe, you know, we might be able to get our hands on DVD soon.
Well, I don't think there are any ownership hassles or roadblocks. I think it's just a matter of doing it, really. And Steve called me. He's a very industrious, busy guy. And, you know, right before the holidays, and said, I haven't forgotten about this, and we really need to get it out this year. So I hope he's right, you know.
Well, I would certainly like to see it, and I think others would like to see it and enjoy it as well. It's definitely a sidetrack for you, but you have a very unique voice, and I can tell and understand when you know I go through and research about you, you know, doing radio or doing voiceover work and things like that. But I think that there's an actor in there, inside Webb Wilder somewhere, and an actor that can probably do some great things in the future. And have you thought about possibly getting involved with that as well?
Yes, and I really appreciate you saying that. But you know, you run into some hurdles, but I'm still pursuing that. But my own other pursuits get in the way of it sometimes.
Okay.
Which, you know, my passion is
rock and roll.
It's this dumbass rock and roll, you know. And so, but for instance, I drove to Atlanta to audition for this movie that at the time I knew nothing about, called The Great Debaters, right? Well, it's out now.
Okay.
And I went over there, and I thought I did terribly, you know, and I just kind of went back going, man, I need to, like, go to acting school or something. And then I got a call back, hey, they really love you. They want you to read again. And I said, when? And they said, like, day after tomorrow or something in some other city. And I said, well, you know, I have a gig in St. Louis that night. And so they said, okay, that's all right. You know, you can go to Shreveport and do it. And about that time, my agent tried to follow up on that, and the trail just went cold. So sometimes, you know, events you already have in motion mesh up for that. And here recently I auditioned for something else. So it ain't over till it's over, you know, and I'm turned on by it all. I don't think that I have the foundation and the training to take on just anything. On the other hand, you know, I've got a few chops, and I watch a lot of movies.
Yeah,
so,
like
you know, and I'm kind of a grislier character than I've ever been, thanks to being a human being who's not young anymore. I mean, it just happens. So I think actually, in a weird way, I was never destined to be, you know, a young leading man anyway. So I think now, you know, my roadmap of a face, you know, might actually make me more
appealing right now.
In
yeah,
more roles.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. And, you know, as your voice, like you say, as your voice gets a little, you know, grislier as you get older,
that's true.
Just as me, you know, it can fit many different things. And I kind of see you, you know, as some kind of a Southern sheriff, you know, and I just see different things for you. But I just wanted to let you know that I really enjoyed the trailers. Even though I haven't seen all the films, I enjoyed what I saw, and I could see that there's a lot of promise there for you. But let's get back to the music, which is really what it's all about for you and for me as a DJ who's been playing your music for years. And,
God bless you.
Yeah. I found out about you back in 1991 with Doodad, and, you know, Tough It Out had been released all over the country, and, you know, it caught my ear, and I said, man, I got to go out and get this guy's record. And I think there's only one album that I don't have of yours. I think I have them all except for one.
Which is that one?
The one I don't have is Acres of Suede.
Well, we'll have to try to make that happen. It's out of print is the sad thing. We do have a collection that I could send you one of called Scattered, Smothered, and Covered.
Yeah, I see that.
It has a lot of stuff. It has some of the Acres and some of the Town and Country, and some of it came from Nashville stuff.
Well, maybe we could have the catalog serviced here at the station. That would be a wonderful thing, because it would only lead to more airplay for you anyway, you know.
Cool,
because
yeah.
You know, the other jocks play your stuff as well. It's a college community radio station. However, our signal broadcasts to the entire Lehigh Valley, which is the Allentown, Bethlehem, Easton area. And we're doing very well at this radio station. In fact, people are taking notice, and we get more and more listeners every day. And we've got a listening field or an area that we cover that's, you know, 650,000 people. So it's not like we're just broadcasting to a small amount of people on a campus radio station, you know?
Well, we'll definitely get you what we can.
Well, I appreciate that. Now, there's a few albums through your career, and let's talk a little bit about your discography, and are there any faves for you from the different periods in your career?
Yeah, I mean, I have my favorites. I'm real proud of everything we've done, and of course, you know, having been the guy who did it, I can sort of look back sometimes and go, we could have wished we hadn't done that, you know, but I'm still proud of it. I mean, it's usually like, it's not ever like the song, it'll maybe be like one part on it or the way we did this or that about it, you know. So all in all, I'm just really proud of everything we've ever done. But you know, you do tend to actually, when you go back, sometimes you're like prouder than you thought, you know. It's like, well, damn, we did do pretty good.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But, I really, even though it's there, and there are those songs that have never been performed live, and I don't feel so bad about that after I realized the Stones had never performed Sway,
yeah,
which is one of my favorites live. You know, it's just the way it works out. Sometimes, you know, things are created in the studio, and other songs, you know, are beaten out on the road, and then you can record them quickly because you're really familiar with them. But like, I really like Fall in Place, which was written by Bobby Field and Susie Elkins. And that was a real different kind of thing for me, which is on Acres of Suede.
How about that? And that's the one that I don't have.
There you go, yeah. And we'll have to get you a burned copy or something, because it unfortunately is out of print. But on About Time, you know, it was cool to... it was a really great experience recording Battle of the Bands, because it was the opposite thing of beating it out on the road. It was real fresh. We had never played it.
Yeah.
But we got our heads around it, and we didn't have any obligation to do it like the demo that we had gotten from David Egan, who was really cool. I talked to him on the phone that day, and he was like, you know, giving us the big go for it, do whatever you want to do, green light. But we brought in Steve Kahn, who, like David Egan, is another Louisiana keyboard player and has played on our stuff before and plays with Sonny Landreth and on. He's a great guy, great player. And so we cut it live with keyboards. We don't get to play with keyboards very often.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was playing. You know, George was playing lead, Tom was playing bass, Jimmy was playing drums, and Steve was playing keyboards, and I was playing guitar and singing in the vocal booth. And my solo on there, which has this weird tone, but it's so awful that it's hip, I guess. It's certainly not square. It's raw. Went down with the track. You know, it wasn't an overdub. And so that's pretty much a really, truly live take, and we had never really played the song before. And the fact that we were cutting it with keyboards somehow, I think, inspired Jimmy to really roll.
Yeah.
In a certain way. I mean, keyboards really make rock roll, you know, if they're right, if somebody knows how to do it. So anyway, that was a real cool experience, and every time I hear it, I think about that. The whole live part of the first album, it's amazing that it turned out as good as it did, but we had what was then state-of-the-art mobile recording truck outside, and we were well-rehearsed and well-seasoned. We had been playing lots of live shows. I was a little worried that we had played in Athens, Georgia the night before, and I thought, well, my voice is a little hosed, you know, but seemed to turn out okay. You know, I could point to other things, like when we did Cold Front, David Grissom and I played rhythm guitar together when we tracked that, and later I was in the studio when he overdubbed all that unbelievable lead he did on it on Hybrid Vigor. You know, just memories like that are cool.